Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Today we embark upon a subject which is, I have a feeling, rather dangerous. In the past, discussion of flags has led to all sorts of difficulties. Knowing, however, that our normal audience to these lectures are a very sober and clear-minded group of people, I don't expect any riots, but if anybody is planning to start one, would they kindly let me know in advance. Flags has been a somewhat dangerous subject in the past. Today we're privileged to have Dr. Elizabeth Kwon, who has written what I think is the only comprehensive history of the Australian flag, which is in this book here, and copies of which just happen to be on sale at the desk outside the theatre. I assure you I received no royalties, directly or indirectly, from the sale of this book, but it's a book that I commend to you, as I say, the comprehensive history of the subject, copiously illustrated. For this diligent research, we should all be very grateful to Dr. Kwon. Would you please welcome her?
Thank you very much for those welcoming words, and I do apologise for the late start for which I'm responsible. When I opened my briefcase, the manila folder with my lecture wasn't there, and I suddenly realised I had left it in the women's room, so I raced off and it wasn't there, and it's not in lost property. But the procedure officer very kindly running off another copy. And in the meantime, I'll start with the website copy of the paper, which is the same text, but it doesn't have my cues for the pictures behind me. And as you can imagine, with a subject like this, images are very important. The Australian national flag has become the most familiar of our national symbols. Less familiar is the Commonwealth coat of arms. Parliament House in Canberra, completed in 1988, displays both the flag high above the building, day and night, and the coat of arms above its front entrance. Their bold central display provides a sharp contrast to the two sets of flags and arms, British and Australian, on Australia's Provisional Parliament House, completed in 1927, now known as Old Parliament House. The Union Jack and Australian Blue Ensign flew above the roof of that building, not every day, but on special days. Armistice Day, November 11th, was one of them, later known as Remembrance Day. In front of the building on that day, in the interwar years, was a yardarm carrying the Union Jack and the Australian Blue Ensign as saluting flags. Those familiar with flag protocol will notice that the Union Jack had the position of honour as the national flag at the viewer's left, emphasising Australians' British nationality. That is really one of the most important points I want to make today. For those of you who are not familiar with flag protocol requires that the national flag of a country in its own country has the position of honour. It takes precedence over all other flags. And the precedence is indicated by being on the viewer's left. So you can see, obviously, in 1928, the British Union Jack had precedence. That was the national flag. That dual display of flags has now gone, but the coats of arms, now painted, but not accurately, can still be seen above the rounded feature windows either side of the front entrance. The British arms on the left, with English, Scottish and Irish symbols, and the Australian arms on the right, with the symbols of the six federating states. The arms on the doorknobs at the front entrance displayed the same precedence. And if you're curious about why the Australian arms on the right are so much more polished than the British arms on the left, it's because most people are right-handed, and as they approach the door, that's the one they reach out for. Both doors can be used. Official Australian national symbols began to emerge soon after Federation in 1901 with the two shipping flags, the seal and the coat of arms, which were gradually adopted and adapted. But when did an Australian flag, the Australian nation's chief symbol, replace the British flag as the national flag? Newsreel images of flags on Parliament House provide the answer. In June 1951, when Australians were celebrating the Jubilee of Federation, the Union Jack still took precedence as the national flag. Not until February 1954 did that change. It took three more decades before Australians accepted that transition. But by then, a Morgan poll showed that a growing percentage of them were questioning the place of the Union Jack on the Australian flag. By 1998, a small majority wanted a new flag. Two questions, and these are the ones that I'll return to right at the end of the lecture. These facts about the national flag puzzle most Australians aware of them. The transition in national flag we made and are still making is not well known or understood, nor are the roles played in that transition by people, pressure groups, political parties, parliaments and governments. They prompt two questions. Why did Australians take more than 50 years after Federation to replace Britain's Union Jack with an Australian flag? And still decades more to accept that change. Why is so little known about that history? At its inauguration in January 1901, the Australian Commonwealth did not have an Australian national flag, though many Australians thought that the Federation flag would become one. This popular flag, a British white ensign with a blue cross bearing white stars, was once used as an unofficial shipping flag along the East Australian coast from the early 1830s. During the 1898 Federation campaign, the Australasian Federation League of New South Wales promoted it as the flag for the new Commonwealth, with the motto, "One people, one destiny, one flag." In 1901, it featured on invitation cards for the celebrations of January and May. This happens to be the image that the designer of my book chose for the front cover. The flag St George Cross with stars, similar to the symbol on the New South Wales blue ensign, was quite different from that on another flag prominent in the Federation campaign, the Southern Cross constellation on Victoria's red ensign. Its antecedent was the flag of the Australasian League of 1851, used in campaigning against the transportation of British convicts to Australia and New Zealand. You've probably seen that flag. It's a British blue ensign, but the Southern Cross stars are in gold, not white. In 1900, a newspaper and a journal, both of Melbourne, first raised the issue of shipping flags for the new Commonwealth. Blue for naval and official ships, red for commercial ships. The second competition was still underway when Australians celebrated the opening of the first federal parliament on the 9th of May. One Australian had already complained to the Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, that every city, village, house, school and steamer is anxious to proclaim the Union of Australia, but not one can do so through the non-existence of our flag. The flag that dominated the celebrations was the national flag, the Union Jack, introduced into state schools to mark the opening of the federal parliament. Barton's government, which had received a request from the British government for a flag design but was unable to agree on one, had launched its own competition for two shipping flags in April. The judges, seafaring men, aware that the British Admiralty required British blue and red ensigns with the national flag, the Union Jack, in the place of honour, and the addition of a colonial symbol, took less than a week in September to select a design from some 30,000 entries. Essentially, they chose the design of the Victorian red ensign. With the addition of a large star, the Commonwealth Star, beneath the Union Jack, its 6 points symbolising the federating colonies. Significant critics of the design, both in Barton's Liberal Protectionist government and in New South Wales, thought the design was too Victorian. They wanted the Federation flag, the St George Cross with stars. Barton, who had persuaded the Australasian Federation League to adopt and promote that flag for the new Commonwealth, eventually decided to send that design, as well as the one selected by the judges, to the imperial authorities. Predictably, the Admiralty chose the design for the two ensigns. With minor modification, they appeared in the Commonwealth of Australia Gazette in 1903 as the Commonwealth Ensign, a blue one, and the Commonwealth Merchant Flag, the red. Later governments of Labor's Chris Watson in 1904 and Andrew Fisher in 1910 were also unhappy with the design, wanting something more distinctive, more indicative of Australian unity. And we need to remember that Fisher was the one who changed our first coat of arms to make it less English because it had the St George Cross. Barton's government seemed disinterested in using the blue ensign, grudgingly agreeing to fly it only on naval ships, not on forts. Richard Crouch, the youngest member of the House of Representatives, a lawyer from Victoria, continued to be the flag's advocate, persuading the House of Representatives in 1904 to pass a motion insisting that the blue ensign, quote, should be flown upon all forts, vessels, saluting places, and public buildings of the Commonwealth upon all occasions when flags are used. Watson's government agreed to fly the blue ensign on special flag days, such as the monarch's birthday, on Commonwealth buildings in Melbourne and Sydney, and on post offices, but not if it meant additional expense, a provision which undermined the decision. But gradually, governments began using the blue ensign on forts in 1908 and as the saluting flag at reviews and ceremonial parades in 1911. Both Liberal and Labor governments under Alfred Deakin and Fisher used the blue ensign to mark their moves for greater Australian control over defence, especially the development of an Australian army and navy. Both hoped that Australian warships would fly an Australian rather than British white ensign at the stern, a view Britain rejected. Australian governments also found that the Union Jack was still required at reviews where viceregal representatives were present. Both blue ensign and Union Jack had to be used. Authorities took some time to adjust to the blue ensign being used. Australian patriots were annoyed in 1913 to see that the blue ensign was not used at the review in Fremantle of the men of the Melbourne, the first cruiser for the Royal Australian Navy to arrive from Britain. The government had to remind officers of the 1911 order. As to the Commonwealth Merchant Flag, or Australian Red Ensign, difficulties with the proposed navigation legislation meant that commercial ships in Australia registered as British ships under Britain's Merchant Shipping Act of 1894 were not yet required to fly it. Australia entered the war with three flags representing its dual nationality, the Union Jack as national flag and its two Australian ensigns. All three featured in recruiting drives for the Australian Imperial Force, the AIF, but the Union Jack was clearly regarded as the most important, the flag, the artist James Northfield called it in his poster for the Victorian State Recruiting Committee. From Gilgandra in New South Wales, a group of recruits, the Kooees, marched to Sydney late in 1915, carrying the Australian Red Ensign and the Union Jack. from Delegat in the south. The men from Snowy River carried an Australian red ensign, stitched by their women onto a larger British red ensign, in a recruiting march to a depot in Goulburn in January 1916. On troop ships, some took a red ensign with them, others the Union Jack. Australian ensigns, some presented by women's groups from home, identified Australian casualty stations and general hospitals at the front. In battle, there were occasional accounts of Australian ensigns marking objectives reached, either a tiny paper flag stuck in a tin of bully beef received in a parcel from home, or a blue ensign sent by the commander of the AIF as an incentive to the men taking a town. On the home front, the achievements of the Australians at war inspired a greater awareness of the Australian nation and a pride in its ensigns. As Charles Bean, the official historian, put it in a book for young Australians in 1918, those achievements, quote, made our people a famous people, so famous that every Australian is proud for the world to know that he is Australian. And we're still hearing echoes of that, of course, every Anzac Day, every time a book and yet another book comes out on the First World War. In New South Wales state schools were now free to fly an Australian flag instead of the Union Jack, as had long been the case in Victoria. Although Australia's role in the war popularised Australian ensigns, war and post-war conditions also circumscribed their use. The Union Jack retained its preeminence as the national flag on memorials, honour boards and fundraising badges, as well as in schools. Notice the precedence to the Union Jack. In South Australia from 1916, state schools were not allowed to fly an Australian ensign instead of the Union Jack, reflecting the suppression of its large German-speaking minority and the closure of their Lutheran schools. Their children, insisted John Verrin, Labour MP, must be, quote, taught by those who are British and taught what it is to be British. Under Labour, I love my country became, I love my country, the British Empire, in the words accompanying the salute of the Union Jack. We need to remember this is South Australia we're talking about, not New South Wales. And it's also just before the Labour split over conscription. Throughout Australia, the conscription campaigns of 1916 and 17 made loyalty to Britain a key issue. The slogan, Australia First and the Empire Second, used by its most outspoken advocate, Irish-born Dr. Daniel Mannix, Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, in opposing conscription, exacerbated religious and ethnic division, especially with the failure of the second referendum. In 1920, when Mannix used Australian flags instead of the Union Jack in an extraordinary St. Patrick's Day procession in Melbourne, Protestant loyalists professed outrage, forbidden to use Irish Republican flags in the midst of the bitter Anglo-Irish War, and refusing to use the Union Jack. Mannix found Australian flags usefully ambiguous. They made the procession appear both loyal and disloyal at the same time. Loyal because organisers could answer critics by pointing to the Union Jack on the Australian flags. Disloyal because there was no separate Union Jack. In such a context, Victoria's Director of Education refused to adopt a suggestion that schools should use an Australian flag to mark Anzac Day, the nation's birthday. Quote, teachers are at liberty to use either the Union Jack or the Australian flag, he responded, but to prescribe the exclusive use of the latter might prove a welcome reinforcement to the propaganda of disloyalists. And this was a very significant turning point, because while our friend here clapped that the Union Jack wasn't used, and the Australian flags were used, It meant that other people, not Irish Catholic in background, hesitated to use Australian flags because they didn't want to be seen as disloyal in the context of that immediate post-war period. Labour's split over the issue of conscription and the realignment of political parties saw Labour become more strongly Irish Catholic in orientation and the Nationalists more militantly English Protestant. In New South Wales, Labour's links to not only Irish republicanism but also another anti-British movement, international communism, made Labour's promotion of an Australian ensign rather than the Union Jack suspect in the eyes of the wider community. Nationalists prided themselves on representing that community in contrast to what they portrayed as Labour's sectional and disloyal interests. In the volatile politics of the post-war period, Nationalists made much of the Union Jack in appealing to voters, especially returned soldiers. In this, they had the support of the Returned Sailors and Soldiers Imperial League of Australia, the RSL, and other conservative groups like the King and Empire Alliance. An Australian ensign, unless accompanied by the national flag, the Union Jack, was seen as a disloyal symbol. The Nationalist requirement that the Union Jack should always accompany an Australian ensign saw the issue of precedence played out very publicly on the flagpoles of Sydney's Town Hall in 1921. And if you've seen, as most of you probably have, Sydney's Town Hall, there are lots of flagpoles on the Town Hall. Should the Union Jack have precedence? Much political point scoring prompted a barrage of questions to the Department of the Prime Minister. There was a related question. Was the blue ensign on shore for Commonwealth government buildings only? In essence, both questions were really about which flag was the national flag, the Union Jack or the Australian Blue Ensign. During the interwar period, these questions were a constant source of frustration for public servants in the Department of the Prime Minister, with little involvement of their political masters. And that seems an extraordinary thing today, but that was the case then. But by 1924, there was agreement that the Union Jack should take precedence as the national flag. The blue ensign was for Commonwealth government buildings, but could be used on state buildings if the state ensign was not available. There were no restrictions on the red ensign or the Union Jack. These were the flags state schools, private organisations and individuals could fly. And so the red ensign became the universal Australian flag in that situation. It was not surprising then that British flags took precedence over Australian ones on Parliament House, Canberra, at its opening by the Duke of York in May 1927. What was surprising were the red rather than blue ensigns decorating the building, if we are to believe the commissioned painting of the event. Surely the Commonwealth's most important public building would be decked out in blue ensigns, the Commonwealth government's flag. The artist Septimus Power, known for his ability to create a feeling of movement and drama, may have painted the ensigns red for dramatic effect, to highlight the St George crosses in the Union Jacks and the carpet leading from the Duke's carriage to the main entrance. Or was it to underline the red ensign as the Australian flag people could use? If anybody has any documented evidence answering that question, I'd love to see it. Late in 1940, the Victorian government challenged the assumption that the blue ensign was for governments and not people by passing legislation allowing state schools to buy that ensign. Albert Dunstan, the shrewd Country Party radical who governed Victoria with Labor's support, had finally tired of waiting nearly 2 years for the Prime Minister to respond to his request to end restrictions on the blue ensign or release a statement allowing the general public to use that flag. His legislation had the desired effect, prompting one Sydney newspaper to declare that the red Australian flag most often flown is not the real Australian flag. Robert Menzies, leader of the United Australia Party government, authorised this statement finally in March 1941, permitting Australians to use either ensign on shore. Ben Chifley's Labor government issued a similar statement in 1947, but widespread press disinterest meant that questions from the public continued. In December 1950, the Menzies government decided that the blue ensign should be proclaimed the national flag, enabling organisers of the Jubilee celebrations to present it to every school. Legislation followed in 1953, with Queen Elizabeth II giving her assent while in Canberra in February 1954. Then the Australian flag took precedence over the Union Jack on that 1954 black and white image we saw. Australians took some decades to understand and accept the change that had taken place. And again, that may seem strange to us today, but that was the case. South Australia's Director of Education suspected that the Commonwealth Government intended its gift of 1951 to replace the Union Jack in state schools in their national salute. South Australia chose to continue with the Union Jack even after 1954. Only in 1956 could school principals there choose to use the Australian National Flag instead of the Union Jack. I was a schoolgirl in primary school in those years. The trouble is I can't remember which flag I saluted. But I've been back through all the gazettes, education gazettes, and they were very clear on, and South Australia was highly centralised in its management of state schools. Even in the 1970s, many Australians persisted in regarding the Union Jack as the national flag, which explains Arthur Smart's campaign from 1968 to 1982 to urge Australians to give the Australian flag precedence. Menzies promoted the Australian national flag by having it flown every day above the entrance to Parliament House from 1964 and from government buildings on working days. The National Capital Development Commission, created by the Menzies government in 1958, erected two huge flagpoles for Australian flags on Capitol Hill and City Hill. The federal government's practice of giving flags to schools widened to include youth groups, and by the 1970s, national sporting bodies. By 1980, the Australian flag had been placed in the House of Representatives and become part of the logos of the two major parties. The flag was central to the brief prepared for entrance in the Parliament House design competition of 1979 and to the winning design. I don't have my cues on this copy, so I'm sorry I missed out this one. But this is Brighton Road State School in Victoria in 1938, the year that Dunstan started his move to make it possible for children to buy, or schools to buy, a blue ensign for schools. And you see the design of our present Parliament House with its massive flagpole, which dwarfed the previous one on Capitol Hill, which you can see in the one below. And there's still the one, well, last time I looked, on City Hill with the Australian flag. Even more, it dwarfs the short flagpole just above the front entrance to Old Parliament House, which you may or may not be able to see. There is an Australian blue ensign on it. This image of the mast above this building and the flag on it became an Australian icon. Even so, Malcolm Fraser's coalition government, when establishing the long-awaited Australian Shipping Register in 1980, and that itself is another marker Australia was the last of the Commonwealth countries to set up its own shipping register. The government could not persuade Australia's merchant marine to adopt the Australian national flag instead of the Australian red ensign, affectionately known by them as the Red Duster. This was the flag, they said, that they had served under in war. They weren't going to give it up. Just as most Australians had come to accept the Australian blue ensign as their national flag, a growing percentage of them felt that it was not really Australian, dominated as it was by the flag of another country. It was essentially a British ensign. Indeed, Australia still had two British ensigns, as it had in 1903 when the Union Jack was the national flag. Morgan polls showed the percentage of Australians wanting a new flag increasing from 27 in 1979 to 42 in 1992 to a majority of 52 in 1998. The emergence of two lobby groups, AusFlag in 1981, determined to find a more appropriate design for an Australian flag, and its counterpart in 1983, the Australian National Flag Association, equally determined to prevent change to the flag, began an increasingly serious contest for the hearts and minds of Australians. Almost as serious was a similar contest between Labor Party governments under Bob Hawke and Paul Keating and the Liberal Nationalist Party opposition. By the mid-1990s, the Australian flag, or the Union Jack on it, was disappearing from the logos of national organisations such as the National Australia Day Council, ANZET Australia, and the Australian Labor Party. Since 1996, the coalition government under John Howard has discouraged discussion about change to the flag by establishing Australian National Flag Day in 1996, legislating 2 years later to make change more difficult for governments, reproducing the Australian National Flags Association's promotional video on the flag, and putting it into all primary schools in 2002. At a time when the Australian community was so divided over the flag. Providing a subsidy to all schools for erecting a flagpole in 2003, and the next year requiring all schools receiving federal funds to fly the Australian flag. Two questions then. Why did the transition from Union Jack to Australian flag, national flag, take more than 50 years? You've probably already worked out some of the reasons. For several decades from 1901, Australian government struggled to understand the symbolism involved in the Commonwealth being a self-governing, not an independent state within the British Empire. Barton's government, which favoured the Federation flag over the competition design, seemed to ignore the fact that the British Admiralty required two shipping ensigns, the red and blue ensigns, not the Federation flag as the national flag. Once the ensigns were gazetted, the government naturally hesitated to use the blue ensign on forts as if it were the national flag. It clearly wasn't, as the Defence Department insisted. It was an ensign of the national flag, the Union Jack. The war brought this issue to a fore of whether the blue ensign was the national flag. People and governments, state and local, wanted to use Australian ensigns for patriotic purposes on land. But which should they use? Neither the Prime Minister's Department, bombarded with questions from the public and responsible for advice on the issue, nor the more conservative Defence Department, seen to be the source of expertise, was sure. The Nationalist government was unwilling to sort out the issue. The press was disinterested. Public uncertainty dragged on into the 1930s. Albert Dunstan, the Victorian Country Party Premier, who in 1940 allowed state schools to buy blue ensigns from flag suppliers. Before that, flag suppliers refused to supply them because they said it was for Commonwealth government only. Dunstan was unusual in his grasp of the issue and his determination to solve it. For patriotic purposes, he argued, the blue not the red, ensign should be used by governments and people. But Menzies, more cautious despite receiving advice which confirmed Dunstan's opinion, chose instead to announce in 1941 the end of restrictions on the flag's use. He feared that declaring the blue ensign to be the national flag would raise awkward questions about the Union Jack in the midst of war. Such considerations continued to matter. Labour prime ministers were usually even more cautious, wary of the anti-British tag so easily pinned on them by non-Labour. Chifley issued a similar statement to Menzies in 1947, but went further in referring to the blue ensign as the national emblem rather than as a national emblem. And believe me, the researcher is reduced to such clues in searching for evidence, because so often I found the players didn't actually say what was going on in their heads. They were so careful with their words. 2 years later, he established an interdepartmental committee, this is Chifley, to consider a range of issues relating to flags. One of them was whether an ensign could be a national flag. There was some support in the Prime Minister's department, a wonderful paper that went into this in great detail. For a new flag, the design of Australians' ensigns being seen as perpetuating Australia's colonial status. With the Union Jack in the corner, the paper said, the flag could not be truly Australian. However, the committee recommended that the blue ensign should be proclaimed as Australia's national flag, since it had been used on the Jack staff of Australian warships since 1911 and was the flag preferred in the Menzies Statement of 1941. But the proposal which brought this recommendation to Cabinet came from a departmental committee planning the Jubilee of Federation celebrations, the presentation of a blue ensign to every school. Perhaps its chairman, the head of the Prime Minister's department, saw the Jubilee as a rare opportunity to establish the blue ensign as the Australian flag, especially since the press took so little notice of his department's statements over the years to establish it as such. When a state director of education, and it was South Australia, queried the choice of ensign, Menzies, as the new Prime Minister, took the issue to Cabinet. Organisers doubted that 10,000 flags could be made and delivered to schools by May 1951, as other issues, including the war against North Korea, took precedence on Cabinet's agenda. But finally, Cabinet made the decision early in December 1950. Government reluctance to negotiate sensitive matters of symbolism still mattered in 1953, when Menzies introduced the Flags Bill to have the blue ensign designated the Australian national flag. He hid the change taking place, explaining that the legislation would make, quote, no change. That was not true. He reassured those attached to the Union Jack that it would still fly beside the Australian flag and that the Act guaranteed Australians' right to fly it. But he did not explain that the Australian National Flag would now take precedence over the Union Jack. Further reassurance was the Queen's assent to the Act given in Canberra in February 1954. Government's promotion of the Australian flag over the next 3 decades eased the transition from British to Australian national flag, as did the fact that the Australian flag still carried the Union Jack in the place of honour, a legitimising symbol. But how were governments going to respond to the possibility of a further transition, the removal of the Union Jack from the national flag? Only in early 1992, after the ALP had dropped its policy of flag change, did Paul Keating's Labour government tackle the issue. Quote, we can fly two symbols of our nationhood no longer, quote, was Keating's view. But with no obvious alternative flag design, and as the target of campaigns by the RSL and its offshoot, the Australian National Flag Association, and the Coalition, the Labor government dropped flag change in mid-1994 to avoid compromising its move to a republic. The John Howard Coalition government's amendment to the Flags Act in 1998 was unusual in attempting to prevent future governments from changing the flag without a national vote. Previous governments had been free to make such changes to national symbols, as Labor's Andrew Fisher in 1912 had in changing the coat of arms, Menzies in changing the national flag in 1954, and Hawke in changing the national anthem in 1984. Curiously, the passing of the amendment against flag change in March 1998 occurred just as the Morgan poll revealed that a majority of Australians wanted a new flag. Government's reluctance to explain the changing symbolism of Australia's national flags reflects Australians' history of a dual national identity. Until recent times, most Australians saw themselves as Britons, as well as Australians. They belonged to two nations. Henry Parkes, often called the father of federation, had urged the Australian colonies in 1890 to federate because of the British background they shared. Quote, "the crimson thread of kinship," he called it. But Australians' vote for federation also represented Australians' desire to be a nation. In state schools after federation, we see the tension between these two identities in the school ritual of saluting the flag. Sir Frederick Sargood, a respected politician from Victoria and soon to be a senator, had introduced the Union Jack into schools in 1901, supposedly to celebrate the opening of the first federal parliament in Melbourne, but really to remind future generations of Australian children that they were British. Saluting that flag became an established ritual. And we need to remember too that until federation, there were no flags in Australian schools, but with federation came the Union Jack. Sir Frederick feared that in becoming Australian nation, Australians would forget that they were British. The introduction of Empire Day in 1905 further bolstered the ritual, again reinforcing the British connection. Prompted by the British Empire Union, also known as the League of Empire, Conservative premiers and Prime Minister saw Empire Day in 1905 as an opportunity to turn the electorate against a growing Labour Party, which talked of developing Australia as a self-reliant socialist community. What place would there be in schools for an Australian flag, especially given Australians' emotional attachment to the Union Jack as the flag of freedom and strength? South Australia provides an extreme example of how difficult finding that place was, even in the 1950s, where country was still defined as the British Commonwealth, not Australia. Menzies maintained a strong sense of dual nationality in reflecting on the first 50 years of federation. The Canberra Times reported him as saying in May 1951, "In those years, Australia became a really well-knit nation, and we became Australians. We are Australians, and we must thank God for that. In our 50 years, there has never been argument about whether we are British or not. We are British." By that time, the Chifley government in the Australian Nationality and Citizenship Act of 1948 had formally defined the status of Australian citizenship, although Australians continued to be British subjects until 1984. Not only sentiment, but also fear tied Australians to the Union Jack. Sir Frederick gained support for putting that flag into schools in 1901 because of the heightened imperial sentiment during Australia's involvement in the South African War. Most Australians saw British ties as essential to their defence. They were only too conscious that the small, egalitarian, European society they were creating in this vast continent on the edge of Asia, far from home, depended on the Royal Navy keeping at bay other European powers, and from 1905, expansionist Japan. Australia's ties with Britain, at the centre of the dispute over conscription during the First World War, became even more important to Australia in an insecure post-war world. The wearing of British ensigns by the Royal Australian Navy from 1911 and the Royal Australian Air Force from 1922, at Britain's insistence, underlined that fact. At imperial conferences after the Great War, Australian governments discouraged calls by Canada, South Africa and Ireland for Britain to recognise their independence. When those calls led to such recognition in the Statute of Westminster in 1931, Australia chose not to ratify that convention until 1942. That statute. The closer Australia's ties to Britain, Australian governments argued, the more likely Britain would defend and promote Australia's interests. That view became increasingly impossible to maintain, as Labor Prime Minister John Curtin and later Robert Menzies recognised in seeking alliance with the United States. That the decision to present the blue ensigns to all schools in 1951 was made in the midst of the Korean War is significant. A recognition that children must increasingly be taught to be Australian rather than British. The Vietnam War, in which Britain was not involved, emphasised the point. From 1967, Australian warships no longer flew the British white ensign, but an Australian one. The RAAF had already made that transition in 1949. By the mid-1980s, Australian governments found it easier to separate British and Australian sentiment and interests. But since then, polls and competitions revealing the strength of calls for change to the flag, in particular removing its Union Jack, sparked a reaction by the more conservative, troubled by economic change and the changing ethnic composition of Australian society. The assumption that only those of British or European stock were Australian resurfaced. The Australian flag became a British symbol. By 1997, Pauline Hanson of One Nation fame was wrapping herself in it. In response, the Howard government, encouraged by the Australian National Flag Association, promoted the flag ever more zealously, especially amongst the young, from 2002 to 2004, ignoring the strong and continuing division among Australians over its Union Jack. Again, war in Afghanistan and Iraq made its task easier, patriotism in schools becoming the preserve of the federal government rather than the state government. The expansion of the number and size of private schools, including Islamic schools, encouraged by the Howard government, now required the flying of the Australian flag if they received federal funds. In more recent times, young people have begun wearing the flag at sports events and at Gallipoli, and more worryingly, using the flag as a weapon. Australian flags at the centre of the riots at Cronulla Beach in December 2005 and the big day out in January 2006 challenged sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists and historians to explain their meaning. Wearing the national flag had become more than simple exhibitionism to catch the eye of the TV camera crews. In those contexts, the flag represented ethnic chauvinism at the heart of Australians' sense of vulnerability. So my last question, why is so little known about the transition in national flag from Union Jack to Australian national flag? The reluctance of governments between 1901 and 1954 to explain to Australians the relationship between the Union Jack and its ensigns left both governments and people uncertain about the history of the Blue Ensign. After 1954, when it became the Australian national flag, replacing the Union Jack, governments presented it as the uncontested national symbol since 1901. The flag certificate accompanying the Blue Ensign into schools in 1951 introduced it as, quote, "this symbol of our unity and nationhood," end quote, since 1901. The flag's Union Jack showing, quote, "Australia's link with Britain." Effectively, its text hid the role of the Union Jack as the national flag and the role of the Red Ensign as the people's flag, making it appear that the Blue Ensign had always been the national flag. With few exceptions, in several editions of the booklet on the national flag based on the flag certificate, governments have continued to hide that history. Yet the booklets reveal clues to a very different history from the one they presented. Why was it necessary to assure Australians in those booklets until the 1970s that they were allowed to fly the Australian national flag and allowed to fly the Union Jack? Why, until the mid-1980s, did they include illustrations showing how to correctly fly or display the two flags together? So the message I want to leave with you today is, we need to explore and enjoy the flag's history in all its complexity. Hiding it leaves governments and people vulnerable to misinformation and myth-making.
Well, we have some time for some questions. Would anybody like to ask some questions? Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones at the side of the theatre if they possibly can?
I have one question, if I may. I don't know whether I need the mic or not.
No, you've got a good voice.
At the outset, you showed a photograph of the British coat of arms and the Australian coat of arms. Now, I may be wrong, but I think I counted 7 points on that star.
That's right.
Why?
Yes.
When we had six?
We started off with six because there were six federating states. But when we acquired territories, in particular Papua, we acquired the seventh point.
So that particular door has been fixed since we came up with the territories?
Yes, you're talking about the two coats of arms on the doors.
One is nice and bright.
Yes. Yes, that building was built much later, 1926-7. The new coat of arms came in well, actually, even on the original coat of arms, 1908, there were 7 points. I'm thinking of the flag, which had to change. The Commonwealth Star on the flag began as six. It became seven after the crest on the first Commonwealth coat of arms gained its 7 points.
Okay, now we have a gentleman at the microphone for a brief question.
First of all, I would like to congratulate you on putting in front of us for the first time a wonderful picture. I've been saying to myself, when are we going to see something we can look at? Congratulations on that. But I'd like to jump outside of the frame for the moment and ask why the Scots, almost independent, the Welsh, who have their own parliament for the first time in their history, right back to the Roman times, and the Irish, you know, the minnows that Ricky Ponting spoke about in the cricket, they're already inside of the European Union. And the only group that doesn't seem to know who they are happen to be the English. Three parts known as the Celtic Fringe are saying this is who we are. Now my point simply for you, ma'am, and I don't expect you to really answer it, I really don't. It's not embarrassing. But they are four nations now. The Celtic fringe, and who is England? Now, they're the foundation of this country. And when I was coming in the taxi here, I was telling him I was coming to find out who my Australian nationality was. And the taxi driver said, "I'm not an Australian. I'm a Taswegian." That's right. Now, I'm saying, who are these politicians that would dare to speak for me and my forebears? I'm myself. I know my family in Port Phillip Bay District of 175 years ago, and they're deciding my flag, Australia. And this is for you, ma'am. Where do you place that four nations that made this country up? Would you care to try an answer?
Well, in brief, I think part of being British, and of course we were settled as a British settlement, is that people wear different hats. They wear several hats. And the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish at one stage, yes, they were all individual. They saw themselves as individual nations, but they also wore a British hat. Within Australia, people are wearing all kinds of hats all at the same time, but in different contexts. So I think that's really the sort of issue we're wrestling with here.
Well, one last question, a brief one. Well, we'll take two if they're very brief.
Dr. Kwan, first of all, if we were so wedded in Australia to the Union Jack in the time of Federation, why was a national competition held for a so-called Australian flag? And secondly, following up on the first question today, why does a Southern Cross design have on its points 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 different points as you go around the Southern Cross?
Right. Well, as Canada had its two ensigns, so Australia was expected to have two ensigns. That was seen as a matter of course. And that was why the British government asked. They put it in terms of we want a design for a flag, as if there was only one, but really they were talking about two ensigns. And yes, there was enormous amount of interest. As I had said in my lecture, newspapers and a journal were beginning the competitions. The federal government was really dragging its feet because it had lots of other things to be dealing with at that time. And that was part of the problem with this whole issue. Symbolism seemed to come last. There was always a reason why governments didn't deal with it, as I've indicated. You have to remind me of your second question.
Well, the second one was, when you go around Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta,
yes.
You've got different number of points going from 5 to 9.
Yes, the image I showed you was the one that was selected from the competition. But as I mentioned in the lecture, the Admiralty, when it chose that design for two ensigns, it modified the number of points on the stars. And it also made the shape of the Commonwealth star not so fat in appearance.
Mm. Okay, last question.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was wonderful. What I am interested in is, when I was at school, which was, of course, during the Second World War, and we were putting up the Union Jack first of all, it was just sacred that you must never let the flag touch the ground. And I'm amazed at what people do with the flag now. They wrap themselves in it, they paint themselves with it, and so on. Has your study touched on that aspect of it?
Well, I guess, thank you, Margaret, that's it's a good point, and it's one that I think we are wrestling with today. And I wonder, for example, the Australian National Flag Association, who keep pushing this flag, how they feel about the way people are treating it. Because, of course, yes, the flag should never touch the ground. There is a flag company now that is making capes, flags as capes. So they're catering for this new demand. It's very difficult to interpret. I guess in the brief time that I had, I made mention in passing. I think we are still wrestling with it. I mean, for me, I think there is a strong element of exhibitionism. But if we're talking Cronulla in 2005, of course it was much more than that. It was, and that's why I felt that it was people staking out ground, and I see it as relating to their sense of vulnerability. They feel that they're being invaded by non-Australians, and this whole idea of to be Australian you must be British in background, or at least European. I think that attitude has resurfaced and is actually being verbalised now since Pauline Hanson. I think a lot of people still assume that in the way they use language, not always necessarily in an offensive way, although of course it is offensive to those who are not from a European background.
Okay, please join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating